were devoted to him, and everyone seemed to think he was a very fine Christian. But then they got a man named Silas Evans, who had been president of a college in the Midwest. And Silas Evans, I think, was determined to make to change the school radically. And he went too fast and aroused opposition. And after 2 years, he resigned, feeling utterly defeated. He used to speak about how interesting it was to get a freshman's idea of Christ. I thought it's more important to give a freshman the right idea of Christ than to find out what the freshman thought about. And then his teaching, I had to take Bible courses from him, and I just didn't like his attitude, his viewpoint. He used to talk a great deal about if Jesus Christ is Lord of all or he is not Lord at all. And I didn't like that statement because I thought what it meant was to take this attitude many of them take. It's just as much Christian work to make a better agriculture as it is to reach people for the Lord, you know. And it was leveling everything out, and I felt it was a bad influence. But after 2 years, he left, and then the dean took over as acting president. He was a good Christian man, but not especially dynamic. Good teacher, good scholar in his field. But after 2 years then, they got a new president who was there for, I don't know, he was there 20 years, but he was there a long time. He was there the last 2 years I was there. He was Remsen DeVoy Bird, who had been assistant in church history at Princeton Seminary and then had become professor of church history at San Francisco Theological Seminary. And one time, he gave a wonderful talk in chapel, Feed My Sheep. Oh, it was wonderful. I was thrilled with it. And then I looked up and I saw that on the platform with the faculty, there was sitting dear old Dr. Gamble, who died a few months later and left about $20,000, just more than that, a lot of money to the college. And he gave this Christian message when there was a man he could raise some money to. But it's the only message of that type at all that I heard him give in the whole year. He usually talked about how we raise money for Occidental, how we get more interest in the college, and all that sort of thing. And he was getting everybody to make it easy for him to raise money. Dr. Freeman, minister of the Pasadena Presbyterian Church there, and immediately the yellow leader, who was Samuel Sutherland, who later was president of the Bible Institute of Los Angeles, Samuel Sutherland immediately got up and gave a drum yell for Mr. Freeman, and they all, you know, of course, entered into it with him. And then Dr. Freeman came forward, and he said, someday, Sam, you must come over to my church. Lita yelled for me right before the morning service, which made Sam feel rather embarrassed.
What was your relationship with Biola through this time? I know you
that period. At that period, Mr. John Hunter, who was a teacher at Biola, was a member of our church and often talked to men's class. And his parents and he and his family and my parents became very close friends. And through them, I met the other people at Biola, including Dr. Otto Torrey. And we used to go down there to church sometimes. But I felt this influence that was trying, you know, to turn the college away from Christian things. Oh, as I mentioned the president, I might mention another thing. There was a man there who had a wealthy man who came one day. He was wanting to raise money, and he spoke in glowing terms about him, and they had a yell for him, I guess. And then the man stood up, and he said there was a musician in Vienna, and he came home one day and said to his three sons, he says, I've bought you tickets for the big concert that I'm putting on tonight before the emperor. And he said, I could hardly afford the money. But he says, I got you tickets in three different parts of the hall. And he said, when I give the big, was it Obligato or somewhere, I forget, in the piece, he says, I want you free to call out Bravo. So he said, in the concert came, he got to the big Obligato. And right then, with one voice, they called out, Bravo, Papa! Which some of us thought was a pretty clever way of rebuking us all for yelling for him when we didn't know anything about it.
What were these cheers? I mean, was it like a hip, hip hooray? It sounds like
No. We would give, we had a yell that every Occidental student had to learn. It went like this. Yo triumphy, Hobbit Swabin Rebecca Leonmore, hoopty hoopty Sheldy diverted, woody all the ivy paw, Honica Hedica Wacka Wacka, Hob John Baldy Bora Baldy Bora, O C Raw.
And that was used even in chapel and so on for honoring somebody or
occasionally. Usually it would be a football rally, of course, or a football game. And then they had the drum yell, O-C-C-I-D-N, O-C-C-I-D-N, T-A-L, T-A-L, Osura, Osura. They had some good songs and some good yells, and it was a very interesting experience.
Now, again, what were your plans at this time? How were they developing? What were your career goals?
I wanted to do whatever the Lord wanted. And I had nothing more precise than I wanted to do. I did think at one time, I studied about the Jesuits and what the Jesuits had done to push back Protestantism and to win back much of Europe for the Roman Catholics. And I thought I would like to organize a Protestant Society of Jesus that, like them, would study and gather material to present to prove the evidence of Christianity itself. And I considered, I thought of the value of history for defense of the scripture, for showing its influence in human life. And you might say that was my...
Had you contemplated seminary at that point?
I didn't know anything about seminary then. I'm not sure I'd even heard of a seminary then. Till my senior year. But I wanted to do whatever the Lord wanted. And one time, Dr. Wyman, I mentioned to him, didn't I, before, Dr. Wyman, who taught philosophy, and he would say at the beginning of the class, he'd have 60 in the class, and he would say, now he'd say, we start in philosophy, which is understanding of the world and the universe and so on. Now he would say, how many are there here who are ready to take everything in the Bible literally? And most of them raise their hands. You could say to somebody, oh, you take the Bible literally, do you? Well, when it says that they led the children of Israel into a land flowing with milk and honey, does that mean there was milk and honey flowing through the streets? Oh, no. Well, oh, you don't take the Old Testament literally then. Well, then he'd say, well, now maybe there's some of you don't take the Old Testament literally, but you take the New Testament literally, he'd say. And by that time, there were less that would raise their hands, but some would. And when they did, he would say, he'd pick out one. He'd say, you take the New Testament literally. Well, when they came to Jesus and said something about Herod, Jesus said, go tell that fox. Does that mean that Herod was a four-footed beast? No, well, you don't take the New Testament literally either, do you? And then with that, you see, we could go right on to try to solve all the problems of the world without bothering with the Bible, because we had pushed the Bible out.
Now, what impact did that have on you? Did you think less of the college and that you, you went on for graduate work? I mean, you must have...
Well, as I say, I was shocked by the general attitude of thinking that this country's got its good points, but it's got more bad points. And other countries are...
Was that revisionism ideology that was common at the time
attitude,
in history?
General attitude of many of the faculty. And that kind of shocked me sufficiently that you might say this other was all a part of it.
But then what prompted you toward pursuing an MA there in view then of this somewhat of disillusionment?
Well, I liked the college, and I enjoyed the work, and I was thinking perhaps, and it's hard to think back and be sure just what you thought, but I was thinking of using history as a means of apologetics. I think that's
and so,
the principal attitude. But I...
you say in your senior year was when you made the decision to stay another year for an MA.
I guess, I don't know, I don't remember much.
Were there particular...
I don't remember any details about that. No.
But you did apply and then stayed a year beyond for the MA at Occidental in American history?
Yes.
Is that when you wrote the thesis on the... you said you wrote, we're going to write on the rise and decline of one of the movements, or was that at Princeton?
The progressive movement in California.
I see.
You've jumped to the fifth year now. The professor then...
Well, I just want to keep us moving so we don't use up all this tape on just the sophomore or junior year.
Yeah. The professor then... what were you saying?
Moving towards your MA, covering what should be,
you're speaking of the thesis subject.
Yeah, right.
He wanted me to write on the power of, phrases in American political campaigns, like 54, like, no, not 54, Tip Canoe and Tyler II, 1840. Election for Harrison and Tyler, and I found that was about the only one there was much evidence on in the books they had there. And in order to really study that subject, you'd have to get access to the newspapers of that period. You'd have to come east and go to some of the big libraries. I worked on that for maybe a month, and then I told him the material just wasn't available. So then he suggested the rise and fall of the progressive movement in California. And I worked on that for a little while, and it soon became evident that all you could do in one year was the rise of the movement. See, they had all the materials for that there. It was the movement that brought Hiram Johnson to the front, and he was a presidential candidate for a while.
Now, if you wanted to use history for apologetic purposes, why did you focus on American history? Was that mainly what Occidental offered, or?
The professor of American history was perhaps the best history teacher in the class. Yeah, I'm sure he was. He was a very fine teacher, and the first year I went there, I wanted to take his course in Conquest of the Continent. Oh, I wanted to take that. But I couldn't get it in. There was a required course at the same hour. And so I said, I'll take it next year. And then the next year, somebody had given money to the college on condition that they give courses in Mexican history. And so they switched him to Mexican history and never gave that course again, which I would so like to take even now if I could. Of course, I don't think he's even living now. But he was a very excellent teacher. He was on the whole, a good influence. He was affected by the anti-Christian influences, but not markedly so. I don't think he realized he was affected.
Now, when did you decide to go to Princeton Seminary and Princeton University? Was it on the basis of that work, your fifth year at Occidental, or?
No, these fellows in the Kenwin Club, a lot of them were definitely planning to go to seminary, but they were planning on going up to San Francisco Seminary. Most of them. I think it was in my senior year that a young man whom my father had helped some financially, came to us and told us how he had been at San Francisco Seminary. And he said that along about the middle of the first semester, the Old Testament professor would give a talk that he called the Wrinkles on Your Grandmother's Face. And he said that he would tell about the problems about believing the Old Testament. He couldn't accept that day. And he said from that time on, you could see a change in the attitude of the students. And he got very disgusted with it. And my father gave him some, he wanted to go to Princeton Seminary. And my father gave him some help to spend his remaining years in Princeton Seminary. And that was perhaps the first I heard of Princeton. And then Dr. Charles R. Erdman from Princeton came to Occidental and spoke in chapel on the philosophy of Samson. Out of the eater came forth meat, and so on. And I don't remember anything he said except his text and the fact that he was a man of tremendous grace and charm. And tremendous charm. But I later came to dislike that charm of his. But that was the first I'd ever heard of it. And then, when one of the professors said something about something in the Bible which he derided, one of the other fellows in my class, who was planning to go to Princeton Seminary, said to me, that's not true at all. He says, there's Robert Dick Wilson at Princeton Seminary who proves that the Bible is true and that disproves the attacks upon it. And that's the first time I'd ever heard of Robert Dick Wilson.
Hmm.
But,
so it's from someone in your class.
Yes. Now, what time did we start? Do you remember?
To recollect on where we were.
Robert Dick Wilson.
And you'd first heard of Robert Dick Wilson. Yeah.
Well, then let me mention, have you got it on? Let me mention this, that while I was there, there are two experiences related to Christian life that I think I'd like to mention at this point. One was this. I was on the debating team my first 2 years. And then on the third year, I wasn't on the main debating team. And at first, I was very disappointed. And then I felt that the Lord had a lesson for me, that it wasn't, that worldly pride was not the thing that should be my objective. And that I do my best. If I get on, fine. If I don't, fine. And I felt that was a valuable spiritual experience there. And then I had one that was the opposite. That was when I spoke to Dr. Wyman about how I wished I could learn to speak in public better. I'd like to learn to be a really good public speaker. Oh, he says you ought to join a Christian endeavor. Then you'd get lots of opportunities. And my immediate thought was, oh, wouldn't that be awful? Join a Christian endeavor in order to get practice in speaking, that would be a wrong motive. So I didn't join the Christian endeavor. And afterwards, I realized that instead, I should have said, I should join it, as he says, but join it for other motives, but include that motive in it. So I've always regretted since that I took that attitude there, which I thought was, I think now was bad there, but it's very similar to the previous attitude, which I think was good in the other case.
Did you have other extracurricular activities besides the debating society?
Yes.
And what was your social life like?
Well, now those are two separate questions.
I snuck that one in there.
As to the other activities, I would say that my third year, I thought I would like to be debating manager. And the man who was practically the leader of the Kennels, it had a lot to do with founding it, was wanting to run for student body president. And the OMA fraternity was backing him. They didn't have any man, and they thought could be elected, so they backed him, while the OWL was backing a different man. And the president of the student body, who was in the OMA fraternity, was at the Kenwood Club one day, visiting us. And I said I was thinking of running for debating manager. Well, they were backing one of our men for student body president. And he did like to, they might have difficulty backing two men like that. But anyway, there was one of their men was anxious to be debating master. And so he urged me. He says, don't run for that. He says, why don't you run for editor of the paper? Well, I had never thought of such a thing. But I ran for editor of the paper and won. And the man they ran for student body president lost, and the one they ran for debating manager lost. And at the last thing, they put up a man against me for editor of the paper, but I beat him too. So that's what got me into that. And that was a big job.
Sure.
They had a weekly paper from usually four to six pages. And the 2 weeks before school was out, they had the election, and the previous editor said to me, he says, well, now you're the editor, you take over. And I had no experience, had no contact with it before, and I had to take it over and handle those last 2 weeks, right exam time. I worked day and night on it. But that was a very valuable experience, which I never would have had except for him. And I'm so grateful to him for it, because while it was a lot of work, it gave me many interesting contacts, and it was valuable training in directing the staff. And I wrote an editorial, one or more editorials every week, which was good training for me. And it was a very valuable part of my whole training. And you see, humanly speaking, it was accidental that I got into it at all. But that was that took a lot of time my last year, and was one of my valuable parts. That's, as I say, the small college, you had a chance to get into different things. And you didn't have to spend all your time in order to get any chance in any one thing. You could have a little experience in different lines. And that was, I thought, valuable training. So I was very, very glad to have that.
I was thrust into the editorship of the student paper in college, but felt that same kind of value from it, but because of unusual and a small setting like that, much smaller than Occidental.
And then my fourth year when I was editor, and we got a new alumni manager. Managed all the different activities, and he had a great reputation as a man who could make money easily and could direct things well. And the printer who got out the paper was afraid of him, so that when he would start to talk about the price that they should pay for the paper, the printer would begin spouting all kinds of technical jargon. And he was so afraid that he was going to put something over on him, so that I had to step in and do the negotiating, and satisfy them both. And there was experience that I hadn't expected to see in different lines.
How well were your editorials received? Were any of them controversial?
In the junior year. See, they threw me into it the last 2 weeks, and in the junior year, there was somebody got the fraternities in school together, and instead of fighting each other, they should cooperate and control everything, which leave all the rest of us out, you see. And so they got a ring. They got a valuable ring they each wore, these two or three from each fraternity. And then the student body president, one would make a motion, and one who you thought of was on the opposite side would get up and second it, working together. But the thing was, it would get them together and leave everybody else out. And there was a rumor that they had closed this thing, stopped it. They called themselves the Sphinx. And I was talking to man who'd been editor before, and he made me a suggestion which I followed. I ran an editorial that said, "The Sphinx is dead. Occidental is once more safe for democracy." He said, "If they aren't dead, that'll kill them for sure."
Well, that was your senior year?
That was my senior year. The student body president said, that was the end of the junior year. The new student body president said, "If I let you half an hour ago, I'd have beat your face in."
So you became editor of the paper near the end of your junior year.
Yeah. Well, it was, you see, I shouldn't really have begun until the fall, but the man who didn't like me much, who was editor, he, the minute I was elected successor, he just said, "Here it is, it's yours, it's out." It was all in my hand.
I see.
So I had to do it for 2 weeks with no experience whatever, and I worked all night on it, getting the paper out.
But then going into your senior year, you had at least that much background and then went into it. And then this editorial, would that have been in the fall? Or?
No, that was in the spring, just for convention.
Yeah. You chose not to join a fraternity and to be one of the
no,
was there a principal involved with that?
Well, I wasn't invited to one.
They didn't try to corral people into joining?
Oh, they did. For one thing, I was 2 years younger than everybody else in my class. That was a handicap. And their biggest interest was in biggest interest was in the athletics, and I was.
They were jock houses, so to speak. Yeah.
Well, they all definitely was. And the OMA was not so much that way. It was definitely that way. They had usually a lot of the best athletes, but they were a little bit more refined than the others. And they were pretty people, man.
Now, your social life, then, do you mind commenting on that?
Well, I first year I had practically no social life. I was very much irritated. When they had a system there. They would call it I can't think of the word. Anyway, I was in a literary club, and then there was another literary. There was a men's literary club and a women's literary club, and two of these would have a meeting, and things like that. And they would have a slate, and they would list all the girls. And then the fellows would all draw lots, and then in accordance to your numbers, you would mark the name of one on the slate, and you would invite that one. And I invited, and I heard someone, one of the fellows, say, "Such and such girl, very attractive girl." I never heard of it. But I got way ahead of him on this drawing the numbers, so I took her. And one of the older girls came over and took me to meet my date. The old introduced me to her, and then she said she was so sorry she could not go to the party. I thought if she was going to do that, she shouldn't have put her name on the slate in the first place. But I think she did because she looked me over. I was 2 years younger than any of the others. May have looked 4 years younger. I but I didn't have any social life the first. But I got acquainted with some mighty fine fellows. There was Sam Sutherland, who later became president of Viola, and there were others, some very fine fellows I got acquainted with the first year. Had a lot of hikes with them. Good acquaintance, but they were all fellows the first year. The second year, I got both sexes. And then the third year, I used to go out two nights every week, and there were three girls there that I would take once every 2 weeks, each of the three, and then the fourth time I would take somebody else at random. I did that too most of the third year. And
how about your senior year and your graduate year?
Oh, I had some, like young fellows do, some, what would you call it? You get a certain charm on somebody. You get over it.
Now, what kind kinds of social events did they have? Were they very formal? Would there be...
The thing I enjoyed particularly was their roller skating parties. I was always a bit shy. And in the roller skating parties, you would ask one of the girls to skate with her, and then they would... they had divided into sections. I think they had an orchestra playing, and then they'd stop, and they would take another. And you had the advantage of dancing. That is to say that you were with a girl for a certain length of time, and then you'd be with a different one. And we would have our sheets, and we'll sign them up, see that. I enjoyed that. Well, similarly, I used to go into school, I would see somebody who was going, and I would walk with them, going and coming, and I made a lot of points with that. Remind me when I went on the Sierra Club trip in the mountains, and I would wait in the camp until everybody started, and then I would start walking. They were hiking, you see, from one camping place to another, a few miles away, and I would walk fast and catch up with the people in the back, and then I'd walk with them and chat with them. Well, then I'd see them speed up and catch up to the next group, and then I'd get into the camp with the front group, but that way, I would just casually have time with acquaintance with different ones.
For them, I enjoyed delightful.
I enjoyed that very much.
Dr. McRae, if I may, this Kenwan's Club, I get this?
Kenwan, Kenowan. I don't know where they got that name.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask next.
Kenwan Club. It continued. My first 3 years, my last 4 years, I was active in it, sometimes staying at it, sometimes during the day. And it continued after I left for a while, but President Byrd said that those fine Christian boys ought to be scattered around among the fraternities exerting their influence instead of being all shut together. And he succeeded eventually in getting it broken up. But they were a fine group of fellows, and they studied hard and worked hard, and there was an English professor who came in who I didn't think was an extremely savory character, and I'm quite sure was quite anti-Christian, though he never came out directly and said so. But one day he talked to me in my senior year. He says, your club ought to apply for a charter to a national fraternity. And he says, I've been tremendously interested in national fraternities. And he says, these local things here, you get a national on the ground, they would just disappear. And he says, your group has the best marks and the outstanding fellows of any group in the college. And he says, you get a charter from a national fraternity and become a national fraternity. And he says, you go way ahead of all these other. So he talked to me like, I passed it on to the fellows. I didn't. But it was a fine group of fellows that brought in fellows that I might not have met otherwise. And some were very fine.
Now, do you want to cover anything more at the Occidental, in the Occidental years before the spring of 23?
What's that?
You did say that in a memo to me this month that you were wondering whether you mentioned attendance. I thank Mr. Haig for pointing this out to me just now. When Woodrow Wilson gave one of his last speeches.
Yeah, well, that's kind of interesting. I told somebody the other day that, Wilson was the only president of the United States I'd ever seen in the flesh. And that's not true, because I've seen three of them. The first was Theodore Roosevelt, whom I heard give a talk in when he was running in the Bull Moose ticket in 1912. And then when Woodrow Wilson was trying to advance the League of Nations and traveling by train and speaking here and there and finally killed himself because he had a stroke, and he was in Bedford about 3 years before he died. And but he was to speak in Los Angeles, the Shrine Auditorium. I went down there at 1:30 in the afternoon and stood in line, supposed to speak at 8 at night. When I got there, there were about 100 people there, and before it was there were thousands. And then they opened the auditorium at about 6, and they rushed in to the seats. And they, instead of starting at 8, they started about 7. But even with all that, they had all the front seats reserved for the dignitaries, so we were quite a distance from them. But it was interesting to hear him. And of course, particularly so since it was a week later he had a stroke and his active life. Somebody said to me, it's just like hearing impromptu literature.
Who was the third president?
The third was Coolidge. When I was at seminary, I attended the Foreign Missions Convention in Washington, D.C., and Calvin Coolidge was president of the address. It was a big meeting. I was up in the balcony. It was interesting to see.
Now, when did you decide and how did you decide to move beyond your fifth year at Occidental as far as Princeton University, Princeton Seminary,
well,
your own interests?
Well, at Occidental, I told you, Ray Braham spoke about Robert Dick Wilson and so on. And when I graduated, there were several fellows who went to Occidental. And then I went to Princeton, several of my friends, and then I told you how this man had gone to the San Francisco Seminary and been so disgusted with how he had gone to Princeton Seminary. But when I finished Occidental with the teaching I had with these men, there wasn't any direct anti-Christian teaching, but there was an atmosphere. Well, the whole world is a mystery. Everything is kind of bad. You know, I said to somebody, I said, I don't have any convictions. I said, I'm not sure of anything. And I said, I hope I won't get any until I'm 50 years old, and then I hope I'll have sense enough about that. And I don't know how I came to say such a cool thing as that. But it gives you the frame of mind, which even with my strong Christian attitude when I entered, which did years under that influence, had produced in me. That everything was kind of shaky and uncertain. And I knew what I wanted to believe, and I'm naturally of a skeptical disposition. Whenever I hear anything, I always question. I always have. And I had questioned all the positive teaching, and I had felt that I could see flaws in all of it. But I didn't see, I didn't have any strong underpinning for my Christian. But I could see there wasn't any strong underpinning for any of the ideas they were giving. And so I felt, now, after the 5 years, I felt I ought to go and get the training I could get with Dr. R.A. Torrey and those men at the Bible Institute. That's what I felt I wanted to do. And then when I got my M.A., I had been working so hard, I was just desperately tired. And a fellow told me that he and some other fellows were going to get some horses, burros, and go up in the mountains and rent them. And would I come along with them? So I agreed to. So we went up to Northern California, and there we took about 30 horses into the mountains. And I went on horseback at the head. I was the leader, you'll see, which was the easiest job. The other fellows were behind to keep the horses in line, you see, and keep them going. So I led the group as we went up there. 2 days we camped one night and then went on and went into the mountains to the place where they had the headquarters where they were going to rent these horses to the visitors. And a friend of one of our Kenwood fellows, who was one of my closest friends, had that year, he had taken a position with the Prohibition Oratorical Society, in which he went to colleges all over the country speaking for Prohibition. And he had done a year of it. And he wrote me a letter, which was delivered to me up there when I'd been way up in the mountains for 2 or 3 days. He wrote me this letter, and he said, I've had my year of this. And he said, I'll be glad to recommend you for a work if you'd like to put in a year. He said, it's an interesting experience going to all these colleges and speaking for Prohibition. And it had its attraction. And I said, I thought I could, for $30, which was quite a bit of money then, I could get a trip, get someone to drive me clear down from there to Los Angeles to look into this matter more, and so on. I thought of doing it. And I thought, should I do that, or should I go to the Bible Institute? And I prayed. And I said, Lord, I said, I have no right to ask you to give me a definite decision. And I said, if I flip a coin or something, I have no way of knowing for sure that you have done it. But I said, suppose that I make it, that I will throw up 2 coins, and we'll say if these 2 coins come a certain way, which there's only 1 chance in 4 they'll come. But that means you're telling me this thing. And if they come the opposite, you're telling me the other thing. And if they come different, the other 2 ways, they don't say anything. And I threw up the coin, and it came down the way that I said to do if I was to go to the Bible Institute. And then I said, let's try this again. I said, Lord, if you want to give me a message, make it fall. So it's to say what you want me to do when I give a different meaning to it. And I flipped it again. And again it came to go to the Bible Institute. Mm. I did that 3 times. And then I even took a 4th time. I took a 1 coin. And I said, if it's heads, it means go to the Bible Institute. And if it's tails, it means you're not saying anything. And it came heads. So there was those 4 times in a row. The chances of that are 1 in 100. Or less. And I said, I have no right to ask the Lord to give me wisdom this way. And I never asked him again like that. But I did feel that he definitely spoke to me at that sort of crucial turning point in my life. And I went to the Bible Institute and had a year there. And that was, it just solidified. Oh, it was good for lunch. Dr. R.A. Torrey, he was great. And the morning devotions that one of the men gave, they were tremendous. And the going out and speaking in the street and all that. I came back to Occidental for a visit then. Lester Bain says, what do you want to go to that place for? He says, when students go through there and they want to come to Occidental, we give them 6 hours credit for 2 or 3 years there. He says, why did you do that? Well, I said, I got an M.A. from Occidental. How much credit do you think they gave me there for it? I said, they didn't give me any credit for it. After all, a different kind of institution. Why should they give credit? I was disgusted they're giving credit for that. There was a fellow who was about 18, I guess, and he knocked around and flaked in the mountains, and then he was converted. And when he was converted, he went to the Bible Institute and he took the pastor's course, 3 years. Then, he'd only had 2 years of high school. He asked the school board, he said, I've had 3 years here, will you give me a high school diploma? They said, sure, give him a high school diploma. He came to Occidental, he said, I've had 3 years at the Bible Institute. How much credit do you give? Oh, we'll only give you 6 hours credit. Well, they gave him 6 hours. Then he went to San Francisco Seminary. He said, I've had 3 years at the Bible Institute. How much credit do you give? Oh, we'll give you a year's credit. So he said he didn't lose any time by going to the Institute. But when that fellow came to Occidental, he was on fire. He'd go out and preach on the street. Boy, he just put me to shame. But then he was going to argue with the professor of theology. He was going to prove to him that evolution was wrong,
professor knew 100 times what he did. And so I would hear them talking, and the professor would kind of lead him on and lead him on, and then he'd lead him up a blind alley and make a fool of it, you know. And, well, he had 3 years of Occident, and at the end of that time, I was going to go to prison. And I came and visited them. He says, what you going there for? I've looked at their catalog. And he says, we've got the truth. Here it is. Take it. He says, you don't want that. You want to learn the truth. Learn together and so on. He says, I know what I want. I want to be a pastor in Southern California. He says, someday, he says, I'm going to San Francisco Seminary. He says, you're chasing after windmills. And he says, someday when you're a missionary in Alaska where it's frozen cold, you come down, I'll let you preach for 3 months in my church. Now, that man was so zeal, so full of fire when he came to Occidental, and that's what 3 years before. So I thought that was a tremendous illustration of the faith of modernist teaching, especially on the people that go in and are going to convert everybody. See, I never took that attitude. I mean, I kind of admire the people that are going to stand up for their faith, but I sat back and considered what was there. As I say, I have a naturally skeptical attitude, so I could see the weakness in their view. But that didn't mean that I saw strength in mine. So when I finished, I was just like this. I needed that Bible study. And we had a man, Dr. McGinnis, there, who had some, he taught courses in Christian philosophy. Their view. But that didn't mean that I saw strength in mine. So when I finished, I was just like this. I needed that Bible study. And we had a man, Dr. McGinnis, there, who had some, he taught courses in Christian philosophy in which he had just the answer to a lot of stuff like that. In college, his classes were tremendously valuable to me, but I think they were the head of most. And eventually he got out a book on Peter, the fisherman philosopher, which some people thought just heretical, and they had a big fight. And he was out of so that was a couple years later. But he was a real blessing.
Did they encourage you at Biola to go to Princeton?
Oh, I said to Dr. Torrey, I said, how am I to know the will of God? Dr. Torrey says, I've got a sermon on. He said, you get such a book that I got a sermon. So I read his sermon. And the point of his sermon was you want to get rid of personal ambitions, personal desires. He said when he had a big ministry in Minneapolis and they wanted to start Moody Bible Institute, Moody asked him to leave his fine work in Minneapolis and come and start the institute. And he said he took 3 days to consider the matter, and he said he spent the 3 days seeing to it that he got rid of all personal motives, that it wasn't which would give me the more fame or which would I enjoy best or anything else, but it's which will be the Lord's will, that will advance his will. And if you get rid of the personal desires and attitudes, the Lord can lead you, the Lord will lead you. And then I said to God, I said, Dr. Torrey, I'd like to have another year at the Institute, but I said, I'm thinking of going to Princeton Seminary this year. He says, Al, I'd like you to have another year at the Institute. He said, you'd find if you could. But he said, whatever you do, don't you fail to get that 3-year course at Princeton Seminary. He said, they've got the best defense of the Scripture, of the Bible, that you'll find anywhere in the world today. He said, you must get there. So there was strong interest in that
group. Do you recall the application process and what?
There wasn't any. You need a letter from your, at those days, you need a letter from your pastor. You needed a diploma. You needed a diploma. You needed a diploma from a college. And I thought, so I carried my diploma and I got a letter from my pastor. And I showed up. You need right away. Well, maybe a better
time. Let's start out by the question.
Okay. It's now Saturday, May 6th, 1989. We're meeting at the one of the classrooms at the seminary, interviewing Dr. McRae. And last time, Dr. McRae, we were talking about your decision to go to seminary and your decision for Princeton, and then you mentioned there was no application procedure in seminary for seminary in those days. You just showed up, so maybe we could go back and pick up on your decision first on for seminary, and then how you happened to decide on Princeton, or how I guess you could wait until the last minute to decide since there was no application process or acceptance.
But a very good friend of mine from college went to Princeton, and I guess it was through them that I came to Princeton. Then when I was at the Bible Institute there, this book by Machen came out, Christianity and Liberalism, and I started reading it and I couldn't lay it down until I finished it. It was so exactly fit to what I had observed in college about the unbelief. I don't like the title liberalism a bit because so much is good is called liberal. I hate to call it by that name. In fact, in those days, we mostly called it modernism. But today, they don't use that term. But as Dr. Machen points out in this book, the ideas of the so-called liberals are not only they're not Christianity, they belong to an entirely, not only a different religion, but an entirely different series of religions, a different type of religion altogether from Christianity. And in this book, he shows how their idea of doctrine is different, their idea of God is different, their idea of man, of the Bible, of Christ, of salvation, the church. So on every one of these, the liberal idea is completely different from the historic Christian attitude. And yet in most of our so-called Christian colleges today, of any age, they are using Christian terminology but teaching what is absolutely contrary to Christian.
Did this book then cement your decision for Princeton?
I suppose it helped, but I was already.
You didn't consider other schools?
No. No,
did it help encourage you to decide on seminary rather than, say, a teaching career in history? The book by Machen?
I don't know. That I don't
remember. Sure.
I think I sort of followed along with these other friends of mine.
Mm-hmm.
They were very positive, and they felt that person was what they wanted. And, of course, they had been there 2 years before I went, because after I graduated from college, I had graduated here, and then I went to Bible Institute here. And then I think I mentioned last week how I mentioned to Dr. R.E. Torrey, the great evangelist who held campaigns all over the world, who I think had as much influence over my life as anyone I ever met. And I mentioned to him that I wished I could have a second year at the Bible Institute, but that I was thinking of going to Princeton Seminary. And he said to me, I wish you could get the second year here, but he said, whatever you do, don't fail to get that course at Princeton Seminary. He said, that's the best defense of the Bible and Christianity that there is anywhere in the world today. And of course, that would have cemented my desire if I hadn't already. I've been pretty well decided that some time I would go there.
What was the feeling of your parents, your sister, and your pastor, and others who were around you at that time? Did they encourage you in that direction?
Well, I had been thinking quite a bit in college of going into history with the idea of showing the evidence that Christianity was a vital factor in the strength of our Western nations in the development of science and in the development of the ideas of freedom and democracy that we have, and using that as an argument for Christianity and going into those evidence at length. In fact, when I was in Princeton, I went up to Columbia University and saw Dr. Carlton Hayes, who then was one of the best known modern historians, and discussed it and coming to study with him after I finished seminary. But I was anxious to work in that direction. And then one time I mentioned this to my father, and he said, "Stay close to the Bible, stay close to the Bible." He was a physician. And my mother said, "Why?" She said, "Why she said that?" She said, "That doesn't sound like him." But it had a real influence on me. Hmm. I asked him once if he thought I should do, try to become a doctor. He says, "I wouldn't want to influence you because I might influence the difficult teachers too much," or something like that. Mm-hmm. So I think he would sort of like me to follow this line. But this remark that this stay close to the Bible had quite an influence on that.
So there was no opposition in any case?
No opposition.
From your mother or father?
I should say
that. What was your sister doing at this time?
She was 2.5 years younger than I was. And she was 4 years behind me in school. I think she had a brain that's every bit as good as mine, but she didn't have the interest in intellectual things that I always had from kindergarten on. She didn't. I just loved school. To her, school was sort of a necessary evil, I think.
Did she go to college?
She went to college, yes.
At Occidental?
At Occidental.
And graduated.
Yes.
And what did she do after that?
She went and took some graduate work in Massachusetts somewhere, and then she got married.
And settled in Massachusetts?
No. She didn't marry in Massachusetts. She got married in Los Angeles.
Now, did she stay in Los Angeles with your parents until they passed away, or?
She was, yes. Yes, I think she was in the city at least with them until they after their death, and then she was taken ill, and her husband was getting on in years, and they came to their son who was in south of Washington. Her husband was her daughter's son was south of Washington. He took the old folks in.
This would be just in the last 20, 30 years.
Yeah.
I see. Okay. How many children did they have?
Sorry. Yeah, I kind of lost
touch. You keep in touch with your nieces and nephews?
No, I haven't. No. They went quite a different direction.
Did they follow your sister and her family follow your career with interest?
I don't think so. I remember when her little girl was, her daughter was like 4 or 5, I mean, she was very small. I went home for a brief visit to Los Angeles, and I heard of Frank Sinatra for the first time. They were talking about the Sinatra swooners, and this little girl told me she was one of the Sinatra swooners. But their interests were quite different.
I see. What did her husband?
Just
except for the biographical aspect, which we'd like to focus on. What did her husband do in Washington?
He didn't do anything in Washington. It was his son-in-law who took them when they both were getting along in years.
Mm-hmm.
Took them there.
Right.
They weren't able to take care of themselves. So that's quite a side.
Sure. I just, you know, the biographical end we want to be sure to pick up along the way. So.
Yeah.
Did you then, what did you do that summer then between Biola and Princeton? Were you preparing to move east and or did you have some kind of a job, or how did you, you say you didn't really need to let Princeton know that you were coming particularly?
No, no. I got a, that summer, after the Bible Institute, I went up to the mountains at the beginning of summer with four of the fellows from the Institute. We drove up there, and one fellow that they brought, they had simply told, you just bring a blanket, that's all you need. Well, I had my good sleeping bag. And when we got up there, going up in those high mountains, camping over 10,000 feet, this fellow had had pneumonia once and nearly died, and all he had was one little blanket. These others all had more, but this fellow, that's what they had told him. So we got up in the mountains there, and I gave him my sleeping bag every night, and I took his one blanket and hunted around and found a place where you could get down among the bushes or something where there was good shelter. And so we had like 10 days, a very fun trip to get up in the mountains. And then I went to the synod meeting, which was in Los Angeles, I think, and somehow I forget the details of that. Oh, and I met one of my college friends who had been at the General Assembly that summer and had been with William, had been secretary for William Jennings Bryan, while a friend of his had been secretary for Dr. McCarthy, who was elected moderator of the General Assembly and was taking the stand in the Assembly against having positive preaching in a Presbyterian church. But the modernists had sufficient control in the Assembly that though the majority wanted to get rid of Fosdick from the Presbyterian Church, they simply voted to tell New York Presbytery that they should invite Fosdick to come before the Presbytery and be examined if he was to preach it, continue preaching regularly at Presbyterian Church, and that way they got rid of it. And Rockefeller built that tremendous big Riverside church so that Fosdick didn't lose anything by no longer preaching. Then I got a phone call from this fellow that I had known in college one day, and he said, Dr. Alice, I hadn't heard of Dr. Alice, though. He said, he lived 50 miles from us. And this fellow did, and he says, I'm bringing Dr. Alice down as far as San Fernando. That was 20 miles from Los Angeles. He says, you run up there and get him. So I drove to San Fernando and met this fellow I'd never heard of, but he was Robert Dick Wilson's assistant. And I met him, and Dr. McCartney, who was a very close friend of his, who had been moderator of the General Assembly that summer, was up in San Francisco, and he and Dr. Alice wanted to see something in the mountains.
This assistant to Robert Dick Wilson wanted to see something in the mountains?
He and Dr. McCartney wanted to see something in the California mountains.
Now, he wasn't, I'm unclear as to who the he was.
Dr. McCartney.
I see. Dr. McCartney and Dr. Alice?
Yes.
Okay, and who was the assistant to Robert Dick Wilson?
Well, Dr. Wilson was a professor, and Alice was assistant.
Oh, Alice was the assistant at that time.
Yes.
I see.
Yes.
So Alice and McCartney were together there in San Francisco, yes, traveling? Or
Dr. Alice was visiting this friend of mine, and he drove him to San Fernando, 20 miles from Los Angeles, and phoned me to go and get him. That was the first time I'd ever heard of him.
Of Alice?
Of Alice.
Do you know Alice? Oswald Alice was one of the professors who left Princeton to found Westminster.
How do you spell that?
A-L-L-I-S.
So I went up there to San Fernando and got Professor Alice and brought him home. And then I had a good friend named Frank Nelson with me, who had graduated from college with me. And he and I and Dr. Alice and Dr. McCartney went up in the San Jacinto Mountains in Southern California and stayed at a resort there for a few days. So I got to
Clarence Edward McCartney?
Yes.
The moderator of the General Assembly?
Yes.
Well, that must have been an intriguing 4 days as a prospective seminarian to spend those with the moderator of the General Assembly.
It was a good introduction.
Robert Dick Wilson's assistant, who would then be a professor at Westminster and so on.
Yeah.
Oh, could you elaborate on that? What was Dr. McCartney, what was his frame of mind? Did he talk at all about the Assembly or about his election, or were you talking about natural sights and other things?
Yes, one night there, he got to talking with a Roman Catholic girl. McCartney's never married, neither did Alice. And I think he was arguing with her about whether ministers should be married. And he wasn't married, but he thought they should be, because he said that the families of the children of the mass had made a tremendous contribution to the country. And I don't know that he'd seen a book, or maybe might have even written one, for all I know. It's Tracy, Children of Ministers, and how many prominent people have done that.
Children of the Mass sounds like the title of something he might write. Of course, he did write many popular works.
Yes, he was a very, very interesting fellow. And later on, one time, when I was going west after one of my years at seminary, I got on the train in New Mexico and found McCartney on the train heading for the General Assembly in San Francisco. And I said, I'm going to climb the San Francisco Mountains, which are 60 miles south of the Grand Canyon. I said, won't you join me? He said, all right. So he and I got off the train at not Winslow, the next place beyond Winslow. I forget now. And we got off there, and we rented a blanket for him, and we walked up into the San Francisco Mountains, which are 60 miles south of the Grand Canyon. You can look across and look into it a bit. And Dr. McCartney and I walked halfway up the mountain, and then we got into a tremendous rainstorm, and we found a deserted Indian hogan, which we got into. And there was a goat already on this bed of straw there. So poor Dr. McCartney slept in the middle between the goat and me. I don't know which was worse for him.
No.
But in the long early morning, the rain was over, he found, so he drove the goat out of the hogan. But
that sounds almost apocryphal. I mean, how would heading for the assembly as the moderator the preceding year, running into this, you were to him what, just some...
Well, I'd met him, you see, this was 2 years. This was 3 years after he'd been moderator. This was after I'd had 2 years at Seminary.
Oh, this was after you'd had 2 years at Princeton.
Yeah.
And he was where? Was he at First Presbyterian in Pittsburgh by then? Or?
Yes.
I see. Huh. How about that? But he recognized you, or had you seen him in between?
I saw him after my first year at seminary. I went to the General Assembly, which was meeting in Baltimore. I think it was Baltimore. And McCartney was quite prominent in the meeting there then, and I saw him at that time too. So I kept up friendship for some years with him, and of course Dr. Alice was his best friend, and I was very into Dr. Alice. I was having met him in California that way, and Dr. Alice did me a tremendous favor. He taught Hebrew. And he would present a point, and he would explain it so clearly. And then he'd explain it over again. And then he'd do it again. By the sixth time, I was so bored to death. Then somebody put their hand, would you please explain so-and-so? Then he'd explain it the second time, very patiently. And that was the way he did. So in the fall of my first year, he invited me to go with him to the football game. So I went with him to the game, and I thought I would compliment him. I said, "Oh," I said, "you make that Hebrew so clear, so simple." I said, "I never have to spend more than 20 minutes a lesson on." He said, "You don't. You don't put the word man on it." But he says, "You're not interested in getting into the Aleph division, then, are you?" See, he would divide. He would give an examination about Thanksgiving. And after that examination, he would pick out maybe 10 of the class to go with Dr. Robert Wilson. And then a month later, he'd pick out another 10. And they would be the Aleph divisions with Dr. Robert Wilson. Well, when he said that to me, you see, that scared me. So I went home, and for the next 2 weeks, I studied 5 hours a day instead of 20 minutes on it. And I got into the Aleph division with a group of 10 or so. But oh, what a contrast between his teaching and Dr. Wilson. Dr. Ellis explained. Dr. Wilson was the word. He says, "No, the I and words," he said, "there's just this and this." Put some things on the board. I'd come back to my room and take the book and try to puzzle it out.
What Hebrew grammar did Wilson use?
The one he wrote himself. And Dr. Ellis followed that for 24 years. He taught Hebrew, and he followed step by step by step through that book. Every detail in the order it was there. And when I was in Germany, when 2 years after I graduated from college, when they sent me, Dr. Wilson sent me a wire to come and be his assistant. And I wrote him. I had written him that I thought I needed another year in Germany. And he sent me a wire and said, "Teaching your class," he said, "salary $2,500, teaching your courses till you arrive." And that was pretty good salary in those days. And so I got there, and for the first week and a half, he taught the course, and he had them writing I and verbs with suffixes on the board. He covered all that in a week and a half. So I said, "Dr. Wilson," I said, "Dr. Ellis has taught Hebrew for one method for 24 years steadily. And I said, you've taught the exact opposite. Now, what method do you want me to teach it?" He said, "Any method you want." So I worked out my own method. And Dr. Ellis said to me, he says, "Dr. Wilson has an awful lot to be responsible for." He says, "He wrote such a hard grammar, those students have puzzled over it." Well, I disregarded his order of grammar. I worked out an order that was logical. And I took the main points and stressed them. And it made it all very different. But Dr. Ellis just patiently followed to see that book. I remember one time about this third week, I guess, I was teaching, I asked the class, I said, "Now, here's the chapter on method in Dr. Wilson's book." I said, "Please take these exercises and say what the method means in each case." The method is a little mark up and down, under a letter. And he began the section and he said, "The method is ordinarily the mark of the secondary accent, but," he says, "it has certain other less prominent uses." And then it gave 20 different uses. And then it said 21, there are also some rare uses for the method. Well, when the fellows brought their papers in, I found that they put 3/4 of them under this last one, certain other rare unusual usages. And you see, they all were the first. That it's commonly the mark of the secondary accent. And nobody in the class had gotten it, you see.
It was obscured by all this elaboration.
So Dr. Wilson, Dr. Ellis said, "Dr. Wilson has a lot to answer for." But I thought that was the wrong way to teach, you see. And I was very fortunate, you see, because Dr. Ellis was 1, 2, 3. He was very methodical. And they really learned it from a lot of them. But See, I would teach it. I would explain a thing once, and then I'd ask somebody in the class to explain. He would explain it 6 times. And then when they asked him, he'd explain it 7 times. And I had a fellow after and came into my second year class who had been at the University of Pennsylvania and taken graduate work. And he's Dr. Skilton, who you've probably heard of.
Sure.
And after 2 months, he came up to me and he said, I've been in classes with quite a number of ancient modern languages. He said, I never saw people make the progress that you've made in this class. You see, I worked on a system halfway between the two. Dr. Wilson died at the beginning of the second year. And then, of course, I was Dr. Alice's assistant. And Dr. Alice, I think, might well have said to me, now, I want you to do like I did with Dr. Wilson. He was straight through. So I kind of had the feeling he'd do that. So I just kept away from the subject. And having been under Wilson here, I was free to use my own method. And I heard years later that he told someone else that Mr. McCrae can keep silent in several ancient and modern languages.
Well,
your question kind of led us off.
Sure,
on the
well,
right
that's
path.
Okay. That we'll pick up again when we get to your Princeton years on some of those things, which are really among the most fascinating, I think, that we want to treat through the whole series of interviews. But this time with McCartney and Alice and yourself and someone else, I guess it was your friend.
Yep.
That was the summer before you entered Princeton.
Yep. Yep.
And Alice was a professor at Princeton then?
Assistant professor.
Okay. So did you have a sense during those 4 days and also during later with McCartney and so on of history making? Was there a sense, I mean, it must have, not having gone to seminary yet, you must have had some, being, 21, 22 years old, there must have been a certain sense of excitement to learn what you could from the moderator of the General Assembly, the assistant professor from Princeton, and so on. Could you explain a little bit more about that summer and then lead us up to when you got on the train and headed east?
Well, there's so many little incidents that don't feel as if they're very important for the whole progress. But I think the thing in particular was that I was beginning by this time to have more of a realization of the truth of what Dr. Machen brings out in his book, Christianity and Liberalism, about the widespread of liberalism in our universities and our colleges. And when I was at the Bible Institute, they held a conference at a church somewhere near there, which was a conference on religion, science, and education. And they had famous speakers like the president of Stanford University. And it was just a few blocks from where I was at the Institute, so I went over to all the meetings. And they would have a man speak, and they were all liberal messages. But it was sad to see some lovely old ladies sitting there. And when this man would say, Jesus never learned anything, knew anything but what he learned in school, and he'd say it so piously, she'd say, isn't that beautiful? Isn't that lovely? And you had the feeling, you know, of sadness about people being given their stuff that way. Then they had the singer, the Fisk Jubilee Singers.
Yeah, you told about those on the tape earlier.
Did I?
I recall, yeah.
Oh, really?
Did you discuss that conference or that sort of thing with Alice and McCartney?
No, I didn't. I discussed with them some their situation with Fosdick, who gave a sermon, Will the Fundamentalists Win?, which was widely distributed. It was on the basis of that that McCartney attacked him, thought he shouldn't be preaching in the First Church.
Did McCartney comment at all about how he thought the winds were blowing at that time? Was he optimistic?
I don't know if I could say
was he aware at all of the tension between Erdman and Machen?
I don't think that had started yet. I don't think that had started.
Well, that this would have been the summer. I don't have my chronology with me. It's upstairs, but we're up to, let's see, we're up to about 1920. No, well, I was thinking of, I have the years on the other one. What fall did you enter Princeton? Do you remember, was it 23?
It was 24.
Fall of 24. And McCartney was the moderator at that time?
No, he was moderator then. Where is he now? I think he was at 24, yes.
That would have been June, May?
Yeah, I'm quite sure it was 24.
And so he had just been elected moderator when you spent those 4 days that summer of 24.
Yeah.
And you knew you were headed to Princeton that fall.
Yeah.
Okay, were there any other...